up in the sky. It's a bird. It's a plane. It's Sci-Fi for Me Radio.
Back on the Rogues Gallery, Jason Hunt here, along with Tim Harvey.
Hello.
Kendall Sin.
Hello.
From Fort Worth, Jeff Hackworth.
Hello.
And dialing in from New York, our special guest, the former production director at DC Comics back in the day, Mr. Bob Rozakis. Hello, sir.
How you doing?
Well, we are doing really good to have you join us. We're very very grateful that you've been able to put your time in here. Now, Bob has a blog called Anything Goes, and we will link to that as well. And Bob also is the author of a couple of different books that you can find still that are connected to the industry, the comic book industry, The Secret History of AA Comics and The Answer Man's Book of Trivia Quizzes. These are both available over at Amazon. Now, Bob, were these independent books that you just came up with all on your own? Or did somebody sit there and say, hey, we need these books, you write them?
No, actually, I came up with them on my own. The Secret History of AA Comics is actually an alternate world history of the comic book business. And it begins with the point where instead of Max Gaines being bought out by the DC guys, Donenfeld and... here's where my age shows, and I'm blanking on Donenfeld's partner. Anyway, instead of them buying out AA Comics, it turned around the other way, and Gaines buys them out. And so DC is absorbed into AA Comics rather than vice versa.
Fun.
And proceeds from the premise of Green Lantern and Flash being the two heroes who survive into the Silver Age, and Julie Schwartz in 1956 sitting in a meeting where they're discussing Showcase and saying, how about if we bring back Superman?
Yeah, that would have been...
Green Lantern and Flash are my two favorite DC characters, so I'm all in for that.
I'm going to order that right now.
Well, and some people have said that the Flash especially is setting up some kind of an appearance from either Hal Jordan or one of the Green Lanterns, because we got Ferris Air that showed up so far.
The color spectrum
is there now, because with the Rainbow Raider episode, Caitlin and Felicity sat there and went, red for rage. Oh, it's a color thing. And, you know, I would have liked to have seen other colors in that episode just to reinforce that a little bit more. But, you know, it's a Geoff Johns thing. It's a color thing. Okay. We're setting up Green Lantern at this point, and I'm wondering when he's going to show up in the show.
Yeah, oh yeah, it's bound to happen. Like I said, Flash is just like, every week, they're just like, oh, this could be a spinoff.
Yeah, and it's so funny, because nobody's making any assumptions about any of the other shows.
No.
Yeah, I mean, the closest thing, I guess, would be the Spectre on Constantine.
Mm-hmm.
But over on Green Arrow, yeah, well, nobody's talking about a Black Canary show. Nobody's talking about a Wildcat show. But interestingly enough, I saw over the weekend, I saw an article that was putting out the speculation. You know, a lot of people talk about the Justice League on TV, that this is becoming a kind of a mini Justice League for the TV universe.
Yeah.
And I saw something that basically put out the premise, what if it's not Justice League? What if we're going to get the Justice Society out of this group? Because you have Black Canary, you have Wildcat, you have Green Arrow, the Atom, a version of the Atom. Now, granted, right, it's not the original Justice Society Atom, but it's the Atom.
Are you saying that this could be like an Earth 2?
Maybe.
Like the TV universe,
well,
is Earth 2? Because,
be,
I mean, Geoff Johns made a mention of the multiverse.
It could be Earth TV. Let's call it Earth TV.
Yeah, sure.
It could be, so this could be the Justice Society that lives in this universe.
So here's how you save Constantine's numbers. You have a crossover with the Flash and Arrow, and Dr. Fate's helmet shows up.
Yes.
And
there you go.
And Green Lantern.
And you tie it into Smallville as well.
Yeah, exactly.
Well, now Greg Berlanti is producing Supergirl.
Yeah.
Over on CBS, and CBS owns CW and Mark Petowitz
affiliate. So
Mark
it's going to be the same
has
universe.
Already said there's a possibility of crossover with the CW shows and the CBS shows, but also he even teased a possible crossover with Titans over on TNT.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm still trying to wrap my head around that one because they're completely different corporate entities. But
it's a nerdgasm.
But the librarians showed up in a repeat on CW after they premiered on TNT, the 2-hour premiere of the series. Later on that week, it was on CW.
Yeah, I saw that.
And I'm wondering what kind of arrangement is there between those, because if that's the case, if this is a long-term thing, then what Pedowitz was saying about crossing over into Titans has got a lot more credence. And I don't know, maybe the Flash is going to be the catalyst for all of the crossing over, because we didn't get any of that, you know, with just Arrow showing, you know, anybody showing up over on Arrow just because they were organic to that particular storyline.
Right.
But now you've got, I mean, now that the Flash is established and we've got powers, now you're going to have characters showing up all over the place.
Oh yeah, well, and that could be hard to manage, but I'm all for it, and it's kind of cool. I mean, it's kind of neat that they're creating this whole universe on television and everything. It wouldn't hurt my feelings at all if the CW did nothing but make, you know, DC shows.
The DC channel.
Yeah, the DC channel, you know. Yeah, I mean, I think honestly we're getting close to a world where something like that's going to happen. You're going to have the Marvel channel and the DC channel.
It could very well be.
I think Netflix is kind of trying to shape itself up for...
It can, yeah. Maybe it can have anything like that.
The Marvel
so,
channel ish.
Well, and that's one of the reasons I think Netflix wouldn't pick up Constantine if it got canceled, because they've got the deal with Marvel and ABC Studios.
Yeah,
but
Amazon comes in and says, "Boom,
Amazon, or move it." Or, I'd say move it over to Showtime. Move it over to Showtime and open up the horror. Just let it go. Just sit there and go. Okay,
we've got
30 years of horror.
What premium channel? Because CBS owns Showtime. What premium does Comcast own? Does Comcast own one of the premium networks?
I don't know.
Because that would be where it would go. It wouldn't necessarily go to Showtime.
Mm.
But all right, hey, so let's talk The Flash a little bit. Bob, how do you think the season is shaping up so far?
I think it's a lot of fun. I think they've really gone overboard as far as throwing in the little tidbits for the comics fans. You know, it's like every name that any character shows up with, it's like, oh, wait a minute, I know who that is. And, you know, some of them clearly are set up to throw you off. And other ones, it's like, well, wait a minute, Simon Stegg is here, and they killed him off in one episode. So
that bothered me. I wonder about that, if that could be something that we could return to, since time travel is a piece of the show. I'm wondering if there could be some sort of a point. Well, maybe that. I got it. That's because Grant Gustin has said at the end of the season, there's going to be a huge twist that nobody's predicting yet.
Okay.
We're going to go through a wormhole, and we're going to attack Jim Kirk's father, and we're going to change the timeline.
Wait. No, there aren't any words.
And it's going to be 1994, and John Wesley Shipp is going to be the Flash.
Yeah, there you go.
Well, I'm wondering. See the thing, is with all of this stuff, and having so many cast members from the original show coming back is so much fun.
Yeah, it's
just
a lot
to
of
see
fun.
That.
Yeah,
and the treadmill is there.
They've already referenced a crisis.
Yeah, and what if Henry Allen is a cover name? What if Henry Allen is actually Jay Garrick?
See, that is my one regret. That is my one regret of the show. That is the one thing I sat there and went, it's so great that he's playing his dad, but you know what I wish?
He was playing Jay Garrick.
I wish he was playing Jay Garrick, because that would have been just...
That would have been perfect.
Because for modern audiences who don't know anything about the original show or the comic book lore, they would sit there and go, oh, okay, that's cool. There was another guy who was the Flash,
yeah.
Right? But for the rest of us, it'd be going, that's just awesome.
Yeah.
I still think, and who's to say that's not the setup?
They've
got the treadmill.
On a parallel Earth.
Yeah, there we go. On a parallel Earth.
Jay Garrick.
There you go.
Because you've got Tina McGee is there.
Right.
You got Mark Hamill coming back as the original trickster.
Yeah.
It's all, I mean, they're playing the same characters they played before, all mm-hmm. except John Wesley Shipp, which is it, you know, that him so being, what, let me use my do. Words.
you get your Earth 2. This is how you get the cosmic treadmill. You get your Earth 2 and mm-hmm. your alternate Earth has, you know, that there's, you know, it's Jay Garrick, but it's his father too. So I mean, right. you can sit there and get away with both. Yeah, I'm for it. Let's do it.
Yeah,
that would be fun. Well, see,
and then
I'm
after he gets on the treadmill and he comes to Earth Prime, who plays Julie Schwartz?
Stop! Oh. Just stop! Stop! Stop!
I don't know. Maybe Bob Rozakis has a cameo.
There you go.
At some point.
There we go.
And this is where we finally get our Amazing Man spinoff.
Yeah. Well, you know, it's
likely
funny.
They'd do an Answer Man spinoff.
Yeah, there you go.
You could do. Well, you know what?
Flash would show up and say, "Who am I?" And I would have to tell him.
You know, that has me thinking that
your name is Wally West.
Maybe maybe we should start an Answer Man column on Sci-Fi for me. No,
we just need to have an Answer Man podcast.
Have to ask,
Total
Answer
Man.
That's the next evolution of the Answer Man. That's the only thing we can have.
The Answer Man podcast. That would be cool.
Yeah,
we'd have to figure that out. Okay, so now you mentioned Julie Schwartz. Have any of you guys been reading JL8?
No, not currently.
Oh, it's such a fun comic strip. Yale Stewart over in St. Louis is doing this. It's basically the Justice League as 8-year-olds.
I read some of the early ones. I haven't read anything lately.
And Mr. Schwartz is the teacher.
Of course.
And it is so fun to sit there and go, oh, yeah, I know who that is. You know, it's this esoteric stuff, this inside baseball stuff. That fans get, that people, just casual viewers, mm-hmm. don't understand any of the history and the lore and all of this. So you hear Julia Schwartz and they're going, well, who's that? You know, but it's funny because we know. You know, it's mm-hmm. like we've got this little secret. You know, it's a trade secret that we're in on. But I think, yeah, if we had some sort of a crossover into a parallel Earth, especially since Jeff Johns has said there's a multiverse.
Right.
Yeah.
He never really said it, other than it was like a Twitter thing, and he was just like, hey, nobody ever said this wasn't a multiverse.
I was thinking he said it at San Diego.
I think that qualifies as a multiverse.
Well, the thing is once you say it and you're a higher up at DC Entertainment, you have to stand by it.
But hold on. It's like it getting a little bit to the comic books. I mean, right now, that's just exactly where DC is going. I mean, it is a avalanche towards the return of the multiverse, to return of so many other things, and the New 52 doing whatever the heck's doing the New 52 is going on. But, yeah, I mean, it's the multiverse.
I think that
all hail the multiverse.
When you've got, you know, the chief creative officer of DC even says the word multiverse, then it's there.
The thing is that they have directly, not only did he say something, but, and where we can found it, that this is truth, is because in that first episode of Flash, it showed, I mean, anybody who knows anything about DC Comics, I mean, if you freeze that and read mm-hmm. that paper,
mm-hmm. Red Skies,
the Red Skies return, you know, blah, 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 all these different things. He's making a reference. Wells is obviously, even though he's his nemesis, is obviously has to keep Flash alive. And we know that you need Flash alive for Crisis to happen.
But it doesn't have to be Barry Allen.
It doesn't have to be.
I mean, it obviously is.
I'm loving the fan theories on Wells.
Oh, I know. Bob, who do you think Harrison Wells actually is? I mean, we've sort of got a tease that he's one of the Reverse Flashes. But do you have any speculation on who he actually is?
No, that one kind of threw me for a loop. Because, you know, I was going with the Eddie Thorne thing, and you know, it was obvious early on that, well, that's not where they're going.
Yeah.
And, you know, with so many other things that were lining up with, you know, basically the Silver and Bronze Age characters, it was like, hey, now, wait a minute. Who is this guy?
I'm thinking he's Hunter Zonneman.
It's possible. Yeah.
I still think he's Hunter Zonneman. I still think there's two Reverse Flashes.
They're setting up Thorne to fall. That's just the problem, is that they have given us a character who, you know, when the first time you meet him, you're kind of going,
And you want, and they're creating him so that the audience wants him to fall.
Well, I think they're creating him. They're creating him so you first think, "Oh, this is gonna be a jerk," and then you sit there and go, "No,
oh, he's actually pretty
nice
likable."
Guy.
Yeah,
and they're gonna.
But at the same time, even though he's a nice guy, the audience still wants
Barry's rival to end up
with Iris.
But I think the thing is they're gonna build him, and they're gonna build him, and they're gonna sit there and go, "No, you can't possibly," and they're gonna yank it all away, and it's going to crush the dynamic between so many of the characters on the show. That no matter what they're doing with the Flash itself, the personal dynamic of these people is going to be just completely
Yeah,
shattered.
They're definitely playing the long game here.
So you think...
He's going to be the tragic villain.
Wait, what, Jeff?
I said maybe that's the season finale.
I think they're going to... That'll take
a little bit longer. Gets a suit?
I think... I don't know. I don't think it's going to be the end of this season. I think it'll take longer. But I think they're going to set him up as the tragic villain. He's going to be... I mean, he's going to be the... You know, every time the fight happens, every time the two of them fight, it's going to be
Darth Vader.
I don't want to do this.
Yes, but there was some speculation in the episode "Man in the Yellow Suit" when Reverse Flash comes through and kills all of the cops and then does a little face to face with Eddie and doesn't kill him. Mm-hmm. And everybody was like, "Well, of course he didn't kill him because he's an ancestor. He's got to stay around to father children and stuff." But you're thinking that particular Reverse Flash or one of them is Eddie.
I think there's a very good possibility that it's Eddie, because you have the fight between quote unquote fight between Wells and the Reverse Flash,
right?
Which could be misdirection,
could be time travel,
could be remember to beat the crap out of yourself when you go back in time.
note to self.
Note to self. Exactly. Or it could be literally Thawne blaming Wells. I mean, there could actually be, this is everything
it's
Wells is doing leads to
right.
Thawne becoming the Reverse Flash or Professor Zoom or whatever he's going to, whatever time they're going to call him. So, I mean, and I have to say that there hasn't been that many TV shows lately that I've been sitting there going, I'm kind of interesting about the mystery of these characters.
Yeah.
They're, it's a fun show. It's got that lighthearted touch. Yeah. That the Flash kind of needs to have, I think. But it's actually got that kind of neat little mystery moments where you're sitting there going, ooh, ooh, I wonder.
Yeah, his supporting cast is a lot of fun.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
And the naming of the villains, everything. It's rather CW, but it works for the Flash.
I like the fact that they've got Cisco, like you say, naming the characters.
It's
because
cute.
Then it becomes just a thing. It becomes Cisco's thing that he's giving all of them nicknames and stuff. Because then,
well, didn't he make a comment in the most recent episode that, hey, that's my job?
Yeah, he did.
Yeah, he did. Well, and
then he made a comment. They're practically naming themselves
at the end of the Rainbow Raider episode.
Mm-hmm.
Because Rainbow Raider
is a terrible name.
A terrible name. But Cisco had been calling him Prism,
right?
And Caitlin's the one that says, well, I don't know, I was thinking about Rainbow Raider. It makes it really silly. And Cisco's like, no. Let me do it.
Yeah. Well, I think, interestingly enough, here's a character who had such a kind of a terrible reputation with fans. I mean, Cisco, coming out of Vibe and all this stuff. It's like when the character was sort of announced on the show, a lot of people sat there and went, really?
Vibe? What?
Seriously?
Yeah.
And I think they've really divorced themselves from anything revolving that negative association that fans had. I think that by having its own continuity, by not having the baggage in this particular case, I think it's a mini character which is occasionally I find myself a little annoyed with the character, but
he's young.
But he's
young.
Yeah, exactly.
You can do
sit there and go, yeah, okay.
Okay, so I'm still waiting for both Cisco and Caitlin to start manifesting powers. When do we think that's going to happen?
Do you think that's going to happen?
I don't know.
Well, there was a chance.
In some of these cases, you have to look and say, okay, Geoff Johns knows that he's got the fanboys watching this show. How many times is he going to poke them with things that you say, hey, wait a minute, shouldn't that be, and then we'll find out later on that, no, he was just poking us.
Well, and there was one scene in...
setting something up. Specifically.
Yeah, there was one scene in this last episode where I thought, okay, that's where, because when they kidnapped Caitlin, and she's in the warehouse and she's booby trapped. I looked at that and I went, okay, that's a spot where something could happen to her to set up Killer Frost. But then I got to thinking, we have to go through the Firestorm arc first.
Yeah.
She's got to have a reason to hate Flash, and she doesn't at this point. So at somewhere down the line, something's going to happen. I think it's going to involve Ronnie. But I'm gonna say right now that the idea of Firestorm being an acronym, since I have to write recaps, it's worse than doing anything with S.H.I.E.L.D. You know,
you realize you just type it once and then copy and paste. You realize that, right?
Yeah,
you
can do. That's such a pain in the.
I know.
I was like, really? You made it an acronym?
Here's my theory. They're gonna get powers for one episode. And they're gonna go away, because that's gonna be the tease. That's gonna be we're gonna get the tip of the hat to those characters, and then we might get Killer Frost down the line. But I think it's gonna be, it's like, and look, suddenly we have powers.
Unless they show up in the multiverse crossover at the season finale.
There you go. See, it's all covered. I just don't see. I mean, they can certainly be playing the long game, and I think that Flash definitely has the chance of running, you know, quite a few years on the CW. Oh, God,
yeah.
I did just make that pun, didn't I? That was not intentional. I did not do that on purpose.
That's just like in the episode when Wells says, okay, now we need to catch cold.
Right.
And he looks back at Cisco and he goes,
I know what I did.
Yes, I know I said it. I heard it as soon as I said it. And it's fun that they have those winks in the show because... You know, the fans are sitting there going, we know what we did.
I just don't see them.
Maybe Gorilla Grodd's going to come in and build a machine that gives Caitlin and Cisco their powers. Like, they're tied up, and the Flash has to save them, but he doesn't save them, and then they get powers. Because it blows up or something.
See, I think that actually feeds into what I was thinking, because honestly, I have a hard time seeing them without taking several seasons to work Caitlin into the character of a villain. I think you need to let that really, really play out.
I don't even know if
point.
I want it.
Well, I don't know that I necessarily want it either, but if you're going to do that, if that is the plan.
Yeah, I mean, you put her in the show.
You draw that out, and then you make it something traumatic. You make it something like, for you, Gorilla Grodd would be great. I'd love to see Gorilla Grodd. That'd be fantastic if they could make it work without it being silly.
Right.
But take it to that point and push it where, you know, again, tragic villain.
Mm-hmm.
I think in many ways, because of the lightheartedness of the Flash, of this show, of the Flash in general, Barry Allen's Flash in general, by making some of his villains be tragic villains, that could actually be really, really effective storytelling.
Yeah, I mean, it could all work, especially like...
It could all be completely wrong, but it could be...
I do think you're right in where they're going with Eddie Thawne's character. I think they are setting him up to have a fall, because all of us know where Barry ends up, you know? So it's like, I really do think they're setting that up. So for people who don't know, you know, and it's going to be really, like, to us, it'll be really cool to see how they do it. For a regular viewing audience, it's just pretty good storytelling.
Yeah.
Gorilla Grodd in the season finale.
I want to throw this out there and blow our minds for a little bit. If this is a multiverse and we look at what Marvel has done, how they've announced, you know, Civil War and Secret Wars and all those different things in their cinematic universe, do you think it's possible that at some point in the next 4 years we're going to have a crisis on Infinite Earths and we're going to see all of these people in a movie together? We're gonna see the Flash from the movies and the Flash from TV. We're gonna see Tom Wellings or whatever come in as because he would be on one of the universes, one of their TV universes, and you have all these Supermen, all these Flashes.
We've got
John Wesley's ship.
You know, now that makes me think. If CBS is working on Supergirl. And there has been a question as to whether or not Superman would even show up on that show. He exists.
He exists in that world.
But since CW and CBS are together, it's not outside the realm of possibility that Tom Welling would be the cameo for Superman.
That's actually true.
It's all possible.
Brandon Routh reprises role as Superman.
Well, Brandon Routh would be in the Crisis movie.
No, because he's in the Atom. Because he's the Atom now. In this universe, he's the Atom. He's Ray Palmer.
Here's the answer to your question, Kendall. The answer is, ask us when we get to the end of whatever it is DC's doing next year. Because if they do what Jason and I have been talking about for a while, which is the original universe comes back,
mm-hmm.
and we have a new 52 that's a ultimate, like it's DC's ultimate line or whatever it is, right. Or you have your multiverse and you have all these different comics, but we get the original universe back, which I'm really hoping for. then the answer is yes, we could see that. If it doesn't, then no, it's never going to happen.
The budget for this would just be ridiculous.
Hold that thought. Let's actually, since we actually have somebody who was an editor at DC Comics.
Since we have the answer, man, that's the answer, man.
We'll do that when we come back from this break. Let's go refill our coffee mugs, and we will be back when the Rogues Gallery continues for our final segment right after this.
Podcasting is our superpower. This is Sci-Fi for Me Radio.
Sci-Fi for Chicks is the podcast by the women of scififorme.com for women who love science fiction and all you men who love listening to us talk sci-fi. It's the female perspective on science fiction and fantasy in movies, TV, games, books, and so much more. So make sure to subscribe to us under Sci-Fi for Me Radio on iTunes, Double Twist, OneCast, and RSS feed. Sci-Fi for Chicks is proud to be a part of scififorme.com, your portal to the science fiction multiverse.
You're listening to the Rogues Gallery on Sci-Fi for Me Radio.
Back on the Rogues Gallery, and we are talking DC filmed media here on this show. Tim Harvey and Kendall Sinn in the studio here with me.
Hello.
Jeff Hackworth dialing in from Fort Worth, Texas.
Hello.
And from New York, our special guest today, former production director at DC Comics, writer and creator of Amazing Man, among other things, Mr. Bob Rozakis.
Hi again.
And Bob, let me ask you this. I got a chance to talk to Len Wein about various different comic book things, Watchmen, you know, the Watchmen revival and all of those things. But I got to ask him about Crisis on Infinite Earths. And we were talking mm-hmm. a little bit about this, and now we've got multiversity and convergence, and Marvel is about to smash their universes altogether. Lynn had said that Crisis on Infinite Earth took 4 years to plan, and we know it was executed over a course of 12 months with a number of crossover books, and you had the main Crisis books and all of the spin-out solo title stories. And then we get New 52, and the word is that it was maybe 2.5 years of planning, and we hear stories of editorial interference and problems internally and all sorts of things that, as fans, we sit there and we go, we really don't want these kind of problems interfering with, you know, telling with good storytelling. And I know you've been out of the comics industry for a while, but are you still in touch with anybody over at DC? Have you got any kind of insights as to what the process would be involved that has gotten us to this point in terms of the New 52? Or was this something that you think, is this normal business day, or is this unusual to have so much turnover in the creative teams?
Well, I think that it's really not that different than what happened when we did the Crisis 30 years ago.
Yeah,
my
God. This is the anniversary.
Yeah. Because you're doing X number of titles and X number of characters, and you've got lots of different writers and lots of different artists, and everybody's got their own ideas, and you've got a variety of editors, too, who have different approaches. So, you know, to come down and say, okay, this is what it's going to be from now on, is all well and good until the first time somebody says, yeah, but I don't want to do that.
Yeah.
You know, I mean, look back to the the days when, you know, Julie Schwartz and Mort Weisinger and Murray Boltonoff and Jack Schiff were the editors at DC. And, you know, I mean, Mort had fairly firm control on Superman, but the Superman who was in World's Finest, which was being edited by Schiff, was not exactly the Superman who was in Mort's books. And the Superman who appeared in Justice League, though rarely, was also not the same one. And the bigger discrepancy is look at Murray Boltonoff's Batman in Brave and Bold compared to the Batman that Julie was doing. They weren't the same character. And, you know, you just accepted that, okay, this is the way these you know, stories are. And if you're really caught up in it, you can say, okay, I mean, we used to joke in the office that all the Brave and Bold stories took place on Earth B, which stood for either Brave and Bold or Boltonoff or Bob Haney. But that, you know, they weren't part of the continuity, particularly when Batman met Wildcat or Sergeant Rock or, you know, someone that just didn't work. You know, but to set out and say, okay, this is going to be our universe now, and, you know, everybody's going to follow these rules, and everybody's going to do this exactly, and the first time somebody comes up with something more creative or more different and is told, well, you can't do that because it's violating the rule, they're going to say, well, then why am I bothering?
Yeah.
You know, I mean, and if you I look think... back at a lot of the crossovers, you know, I mean, starting with Crisis and Secret Wars over at Marvel, where, you know, you had to shoehorn in whatever was going on in the big event into the current issue of what you were doing, and whether it was just, oh, look, the sky is turning red, you know, or something more complex that kind of threw whatever continuity the individual editor and writer had worked out the window. You know, I think that it limits the creativity, and it frustrates the creative folks.
I think the problem that we're seeing, and we're seeing this in all forms of media, not just comics, is with social media and just with the internet and everything like that. You have these, I mean, people know. We're in a world now where people know the writers of the comic better than they know the character. It's kind of like how 10 years ago, nobody knew who a showrunner was on a TV show
or
what they did.
A showrunner was, yeah.
But now they're the celebrity of that show. It doesn't matter who you have in it. It's just like it was a big deal when Frank Darabont got fired from Walking Dead and everybody talked about it. That wasn't even a thing you heard about 10 years ago. And so these writers are now becoming not like name celebrities, but in the comics industry, Scott Snyder is a giant name. And so DC's going to come to him and say, hey, we're doing this, we're rebooting the new 52, we're rebooting the entire universe. And he says, no, actually, I want to finish the story that I had going on in Batman. And they're like, oh, okay, well, you're Scott Snyder, so we'll let you do it. They do the same. They bend over backwards for Grant Morrison or Frank Miller. Like, oh, okay, yes, sir, whatever you want to do. They give in to the cult status that these writers have. And I kind of wish, this is a hard thing to say, but I kind of wish, like, the writers would serve the greater good and just say, hey, for DC Comics, I have this. This is what I need to do. I have to respect what has been around for 75 years. You know, I have to respect that and treat that. For everything else, I'll just take it over to Image.
Except, let me jump in there on that for just a second. And Bob, you can answer this if you would. The things that we were hearing out of the New 52 with the creative exodus that we had, with everybody leaving, was not necessarily because editorial said, these are the rules, you have to follow the rules, creative had another idea, and this writer said, okay, I'm done, I'm leaving. It was, you know, 9 times out of 10, the stories that we heard were all consistent. It was the writer said, okay, we had this plan. Editorial approved this plan. Then 2 days later, 2 weeks later, 2 months later, editorial changes the plan midstream, and now I can no longer do what I wanted to do that editorial already agreed for us to do. And now the editorial interference, those were the words that we kept hearing so much, especially in the beginning of New 52, that doesn't strike me as being normal.
I think.
Well, I think it.
Go ahead.
It's who really has the final say, and I mean, by editorial interference, was it simply okay? I sat down and to take it back to, you know, 30 years ago when I was writing, I sat down with Julie Schwartz. We worked out a story. I went home and wrote the script. The only one who could say to me, "This isn't working. Redo it," is Julie Schwartz. You know, there was nobody above Julie who would come in and say, "Hey, wait a minute, what is Bob doing?
Yeah.
You need to have him change this." And the impression I've gotten is, at least, you know, from what I've heard, is that it was someone further up the line.
Someone
who would
at
come
Warner
in
Brothers.
And say, "Hey, you know, what is your writer doing?" And the editor is like, "Well, this is what we worked out." And then, you know, whoever is further up, you know, next one up the chain says, no, you can't do that. So call him up and tell him he can't do that.
Would that be higher up as in Dan DiDio and Bob Harris and Jim Lee, or do you think it's coming up from even higher?
I think it's coming from the studio from Warner Brothers.
Like Diane Nelson?
Well, I don't think it's coming from Warner Brothers. I don't think Warner Brothers really gives a...
Well, I think this is what...
whether there's comic books or not.
I think we're calling an elephant a fish here, because I think we want all these things. We want to have all these conspiracy theories, but I think what is happening in comics is the same thing that's happening on network television. And that is the reason we're seeing this turnover is because comics, instead of having a long run, it's not selling after issue 3, we have to cancel it. You know, it's like I think it is more of a money issue as opposed to a creative issue, to where they're just like, oh, we have to do what is making the most money as opposed to what is the best form of storytelling. That's kind of how I feel about it, because it's kind of, it's, we said it right at the beginning of the show, is... comics, compared to how many people watch television or how many people go to movies, you're dealing with, you know, small potatoes. You know, I mean, it was a really huge, massive deal that Star Wars number one sold a million issues. It shipped a million issues. Because comics don't ship a million issues anymore.
Right.
And so you're talking about a gross income on a comic that's $4, you know, that's $4 million. Seems like a lot of money. You know, and it is, but when you consider how many titles do they have that ships 10,000 issues, you know, that they have to cover all those things. So you see, and I'm not familiar enough right now with the current DC continuity, but you see something like, well, a Justice League 3000, you know, who is being kept alive just on a whim, and it's not in continuity, it's not anything, and they flat out say in their issues, you know, that they're going to be canceled any day because nobody's reading it. And back in the day, you know, when we were kids, you know, it didn't have to sell a bunch of things. Things were less. It wasn't so much everything since we've seen this in every industry since 2008. Profit margins, you know, I mean, it's all business. And sometimes we want to think so much that it's about creativity, but it's not. It's about whatever makes a dollar.
Well, I think the other thing to factor in is that we see things in a way that we didn't used to see things. Because the public aspect of a lot of this is something that we just didn't have in the 70s and 80s when I was starting to read comic books in the 70s. You know, I didn't know who any of these people were. I didn't know, you know, if the artist changed on a comic, my big concern was whether or not I liked the new artist better, or I thought the, you know, I didn't pay attention to the writers, you know, when in the 70s and 80s, and some of the big superstar writers were coming out of the 80s, you know, the quote unquote superstars, the ones where the name suddenly, but when was a lot, you know, do you remember when you were started reading comics, whether you cared how many numbers of copies of the books sold?
No, I mean, but we didn't have access to it.
Exactly.
Now
we do. Now we everybody knows. Everybody knows the numbers.
Click away. Yeah.
Everybody knows the dollars. Everybody knows.
Except nobody knows the digital numbers.
Well, and everybody knows and everybody knows the drama behind the scenes. Well, because everybody's doing, you know, everybody's
social
doing
media,
podcasts.
Because suddenly it's
we're
all
part of the problem. Sci-fi for me.com.
Well, here's the thing, and Bob even mentioned this, and we can look at this a little bit more. The Where was I going?
I don't know.
He said something.
What are you, Bob? Get us online. Get us online. We're way off.
Throw in one thing. I mean, you were talking about the fact that, you know, you didn't know who the writer was. You noticed that the art changed, but you didn't really know who the artist was. And that, I think, is part of the problem now, is that the business transformed from the characters were the ones selling the books.
Mm-hmm.
You know, uh-huh. I bought a comic book because it's Superman, and I want to read Superman, as opposed to, oh, I bought this comic because John Byrne is drawing it.
Right.
Yeah,
right.
And in the first iteration of that, it was the people who were the stars in the comic book business
mm-hmm.
who started getting, you know, star status.
Mm-hmm.
And then it went to, okay, who else can we bring in to write comic books? And they started going outside the comic book business and bringing in people who, you know, in some cases demonstrated they don't know how to write a comic book.
Yeah.
But it's like, oh, look, we'll put this person's name on the cover and everybody will buy it. It's like, yeah, but it's a crappy comic book because this person doesn't know how to write a comic book story. They may be a famous novelist. They may write YA books. They may do this. They may do that. Doesn't mean they know how to write a comic book.
Oh, yeah, and it's a very different storytelling medium. It's like Kendall and Jason and I have made plenty of short films, and writing a script for a film is incredibly different than writing a novel.
Oh, and, yeah.
I mean, there's just they're coming. You know, you can tell the same story.
Yeah, oh, yeah.
But you're
going to
do
totally
it completely
different.
Differently. And the comic book, and I'm a, you know, my degree's in art. I'm actually a really good artist. I'm a terrible sequential artist. I could not, drawing a comic book would be the last thing anyone would want me to do because I don't have that talent to be a really good mm-hmm. sequential artist. It's, yeah, I mean, I'm not going to name any names, but I think I can think of a couple of stunt authors or celebrity authors who came into comics who I could cheerfully say, please don't ever do that again.
And again,
yeah. Well, you'll notice I neglected to mention.
Yeah,
it.
Maybe
we're
we'd like to have them on the show.
Of the same people.
Yeah, probably.
and for this reason, I have to say, you know, it's there are a lot of, you know, comic writers and stuff like that I thought were really good and things like that. And because of that, I have to say thank you, Image Comics, because a lot of these writers that kind of felt jilted
mm-hmm.
by the big two and their crazy bottom line numbers and stuff like that, you know, Image just kind of opened up this thing. They're like, oh, Matt, come on over here. You own it. You know, we're just distributing it. You're basically making an independent comic and we're just distributing it. And so it used to be, and I don't go into a comic shop very often, but it used to be first place I went, DC. We all know on this podcast that I don't read Marvel. I've never liked Marvel. Why? Because Marvel kills people. Heroes don't kill people. Superpowered heroes don't kill people. But now first place stop is the Image section because that's where the good and this could be just me. I'm an adult now and I want to read more complex stories.
Well, and I know one of the complaints about New 52 has been that, you know, the like you were saying before, the fact that it goes 6 months, it's not selling anything, it gets killed.
Yeah.
And
the turnover on titles in the New 52 in two and a half years.
But Bob, does that strike you as unusually high turnover on titles for books? I know that, you know, we're more aware now of the whole business aspect of it and the bottom line, and it's got to sell a certain number and all of that. But I just growing up, I don't recall any publisher, you know, DC or Marvel, going through titles that quickly. It was almost like a revolving door of just, let's just, you know, throw mud on the wall and see what sticks. Is this unusual?
Well, because they're playing up, you know, who's writing it, who's drawing it so much more, it's much more obvious. But go back and look at the books of the 70s. And how many different writers were writing Superman at the time? How many different artists were drawing Superman at the time? You know, I mean, Cary Bates did one issue, Elliot Magan did the next issue, Marty Pasco did an issue, I did an issue. You know, you didn't notice. And a lot of that was because Julie was the driving force and made all of the versions of Superman be the version that he was editing. You know,
right, but at the same time, though, it was still a Superman title. It was still the same title, and it was the same book. to a certain extent, it wasn't, oh, you know, Justice Society for 6 months and then it goes away. Dial H, you know, 6 months and it goes away.
I think, you know, a lot of that is you know, they're looking and hoping that it will
something
sell
will hit
X number of copies.
Yeah, something will hit.
But also the playing into the whole collector mentality of, oh wow, it's a number one, it's going to be worth millions.
Yeah, that worked so well in the 90s.
Yeah.
It worked really well with the death of Superman. I mean, you know, we printed 4 million copies, and 6 months later, people tried to sell the boxes of 200 they have bought.
Yeah.
You know, and it's like, yeah, well, everybody else has a box of 200 too.
Yeah, I've got a stack. I've got a stack of X-Men number one from that time period.
Yeah,
I have a whole. I got a hold of them. But
and again, it comes back to being a bottom line. And Bob, I have a question for you. Do you think in the '70s you guys were just more of a team? Do you think it was just more of a greater good? You know, it's like, hey, no one is above what this is. That, like, you just kind of checked your egos at the door and cared about the story.
Well, yeah, because we there was no way that we were promoting our egos. Then, you know, no one was flashing our name on the cover and say, "Wow, look, Bob Rozakis is writing this issue."
Yeah,
you know, as
and you weren't
Carrie
tweeting
Davis
it,
writing
and...
this issue, or Elliot Magan. You know, I mean, we were all very happy when we had the opportunity to do it, but we were also aware of what each other was doing. And it's like, okay, if we're going to go way off the map, you know, we're just going to screw everything up. And number one, and number two, Julie's not going to let us.
So I think it was just more of a unified front back then, and I think
could be.
And a lot of what the problem is things like social media. And from personal experience, I can't count on all my fingers and toes how many jobs I've lost to somebody who had just more Twitter followers, because that is literally what everything was. I can always use the example that CBS said, like, they just flat out said, they're like, "Why'd you hire Ashton Kutcher for 2.5 Men?" And like, well, have you seen how many Twitter followers he has?
Yeah. Yeah,
that's,
and that
free,
factor,
that is free
factors
promotion.
Into.
Yeah.
Yeah. Well, and that's something that we talk about here. You know, the fact that nowadays the TV watching experience is not just sitting down and watching the TV show. It's sitting down and watching the TV show and live tweeting and social
which
media and Facebooking and all of these things.
Part of the problem.
Yeah. And like,
do you guys think that conventions could also have something to do with the artists and writers getting featured more?
I don't know that that's the case, because
playing into their egos.
No, because you hear artists and writers complaining about the fact that they don't get as much attention at conventions as they probably should, because all the conventions are
darn cosplayers.
It's the Hollywood people.
Yeah,
you know,
it's about the movie.
You know, we're more interested in Stephen Amell than we are Scott Snyder or Neil Adams or you know, George Perez. I'd love to have George Perez come in here one day. I suggest.
I think that also, you know, you've got such a turnover in who the hot artist or writer is du jour, that you know, that there are an awful lot of artists who were there and saying, "Well, gee, I was the hot guy last year." I
mean, yeah,
I recall maybe 4 or 5 years ago going to the New York Comic Con, and there was in Artist Alley there was one row, and it was the old guys. It was Carmine Infantino and Joe Kubert and Frank McLaughlin and a whole bunch of the people I had worked with for years, and everybody was ignoring them, except for the guys my age, who were going up and, you know, talking to them, and you know.
Well,
we
and also the celebrity
and, you know,
status.
And you got all these the young fans, and they're crowding around whoever the hot artist of the week was, and, you know, totally ignoring the generation that had produced, you know, all of the early comics.
I think that's one of the things that bothers me about New 52 and the potential danger of what Marvel's about to do, because there's no sense of history anymore. Because when I picked up Identity Crisis, you've got, you know, the whole case of, you know, you've got Ralph Dibny's wife getting killed, and you've got all of this history back here with Dr. Light and Zatanna and the mine ring.
I love
and
that.
The flashback is to a particular issue of Justice League where the Wizard has caused all of them to switch bodies. I was like, as soon as I saw those panels, I mean, the artwork was very evocative of the original issue, and I immediately recognized what issue it was, because I've got it. It's up in a tote in my room, and I've got that comic book.
Can I interject here that I spent way more money than I should have, but I do have the highest graded copy of that book.
Do you really?
In the country? Yes.
I have the highest graded.
I spent way too much on eBay.
It's plastic, so you can't read it.
Yeah, I know.
Exactly.
Well, that's okay. I bought a reading copy too.
But the thing that bothers me is with New 52 especially, they're wanting to bring in new readers.
Right.
Okay, fine. But at the same time, you want to keep the readers who have been around for 20, 30, 40 some odd years. And
who presumably are the ones that have the money.
Exactly.
Yeah.
And, you know, and I suggested to the guys at Planet Comic Con this year, I'd love to see a panel with Neil Adams and Denny O'Neill together talking about their run on, you know, Green Arrow, Green Lantern. You know, I'd love to have a panel with George Perez because those are the guys who influenced the people who are doing it now.
Yeah.
Right.
And so much of what we see in comics now was impacted by what they did, because what they did was the start, you know, especially with Denny O'Neill and Neil Adams going in and talking about social issues, you know, with drugs with Roy, yeah, and some of the other stuff that came into those
they were doing actually pretty important
the social commentary
stuff.
Mm-hmm. Before that, comic books were just comic books.
Yeah.
And now there's more of that now. I mean, you see that pretty much all the time now. It's just part of it. But, you know, the age when Bob was at DC and you've got all of these guys there, that was the beginning of it.
Mm-hmm.
And I don't think that new readers have that appreciation for the history of some of these guys that have been around for so long.
It's why I can't read the New 52, because they have just, I mean, and it's, look, they sold us out to get younger readers. I mean, they did.
That's what it does feel like.
And it feels really strange, because I'm going to tell you right now that my brother-in-law, who's in college and he's, you know, 18 years old, can't buy every single issue of Convergence for those 2 months.
Yeah.
I can. Service me. You know? It's like, make me happy, because I can buy those issues.
Well, and, you know, I've always thought that...
Don't tell my wife.
Yeah.
You do realize we're recording this, right?
Like she can figure out how to download a podcast.
I'm going to send her an email. I know your wife. So, hi, Sally. My issue is this, is that comics change. We know that. I mean, we
right.
have, you know, there's a reason we have ages. You know, the sure. Silver Age, the Bronze Age,
yeah.
You know, all this stuff. We know that this, that, and we know that, that periodically, if you've got 70 years of continuity,
yeah,
at some point, someone's going to come along and go, wow, this is messy. Let's try and fix it, right?
Right.
You know, and for good or for ill, it's going to happen. I mean, so you have, sometimes it works, and sometimes it doesn't. Sometimes it works so far, and you can't explain who the hell Hawkman is anymore.
Right.
You know, and
who is Power Girl?
And yeah, exactly. It's like,
which one?
It's like, what's going on? So, but at the same time, when you have something that, and this is, I think, what really upset a lot of fans in our age, and, you know, because I am 44 years old, I am almost 45. I have I've been reading comic books since 1973, when my father I found a copy of my dad's Mad magazine at my grandfather's house from 1950,
oh, wow,
whatever it was, some really really early Mad magazine,
right,
or whatever it was, it Mad or Cracked or whatever it was, whatever, you know, coming out of the 50s, and he was like, well, I probably shouldn't be reading that. Here's a Batman. And then it was gone, you know. So, but it was like, you know, I don't need another origin story for Superman. I don't need another origin story for Batman. This is what they're doing wrong in the movies, too, by the way. Is
yeah.
The whole constant origin story. Yeah, okay. You know, John Byrne did Man of Steel after Crisis. It reset the things.
Legends.
Legends. And, yeah, you know, mm-hmm, and yeah, it happens. But don't completely ignore the previous fans. Don't give
right.
us a character who dresses kind of like Superman and is kind of like Superman, and but he's in love with Wonder Woman, and he's, I mean, just, you know, you're changing core things of the story that
right.
weren't broken.
Yeah.
I think that for a lot of the fans of you know, in my age group, it wasn't
well.
Broken.
The other thing
Why
that they're
fix?
Ignoring there is that the greater audience, the movie audience, and this is what really changed or drove it home, was when they did the first Superman movie back in the 70s. Mm-hmm. The original plan was to go with Clark as the TV reporter, and you know, that whole setup that Julie had introduced into the book,
right,
when he became the editor, and somebody said, "What the heck are you talking about? Clark Kent works for the Daily Planet. He's a newspaper reporter."
Mm-hmm.
And they were like, "Well, yes, that's what the general public believes." And I think even today, and 50 years from now, if you know it holds true, the audience will say, "Oh yeah, Clark Kent, he's a reporter for the Daily Planet. What's a newspaper?"
Yeah. Yeah. Yeah.
You know, it'll be the digital version of the newspaper, yeah, right. But well, he's and, still a reporter for the Daily Planet.
And nowadays, his history now, his New 52 origin includes him being a blogger.
Yeah.
For a while, which is what got him into the Daily Planet job.
Right.
You know, mm-hmm. they're incorporating some
and
of the cultural thing. I don't have a problem with that.
I don't have a problem with the character being updated to fit the time. We do that periodically. We're not still telling Batman stories in the 1930s. We're not still, you know, it, sometimes it doesn't work.
Although the new Lego movie will do that.
That's true. Well, you know, sometimes it doesn't work. We talked about this before, too. The Shadow needs to stay in the 1940s.
Yeah.
Yeah.
In the 30s and 40s. Leave him there. But, you know, you can, you know, a 2015... you know, Superman story that started now would be different than a story that was told in the 80s or 70s or 60s mm-hmm. or 30s or whatever.
Yeah. I literally, gotta, this whole process, literally, I can feel myself becoming a grumpy old man. and I'm just kind of...
Imagine how I feel.
We're actually watching you become a grumpy old man. Bob,
let me ask you this, because you've been out of the comics industry for a while. How long has it been? You were at DC until what year?
I was at DC till 1998, and then continued to do some freelance projects for them for another 4 or 5 years.
Having been actually there, and we've seen some interviews with some people from Marvel's history talking about what they're about to do with their mashup. You know, people talking about that. Do you have any? I don't know how to ask this. Do you feel any sense of personal, I don't want to say betrayal, but it's almost like everything that we've worked on for the last 40 years is now suddenly gone. Do you have any kind of a sense of, you know, your babies have been kicked out of the nest type of thing?
I think it's more a how come you don't recognize that we did it?
Mm. Yeah.
You know, I mean, mm-hmm. it's almost like they've completely ignored that it was ever done. You know, we made changes when you know my generation came in and you know, to the characters that had been around for 25, 30, 40 years at that point, but we still recognized that they had been there and the people who had done it, you know, had been there. And now it seems like you know, there's no interest, there's no concern, there's nothing that, you know, the new hot writer or new hot artist on a project is, "Oh, I'm the first one who's ever done this."
Yeah.
And, you know, there's no recognition. And you know, kind of going back to what I was saying before about being at the convention, no recognition that, you know, these are the people who created these books. These are the people who worked on them for 10 years, 20 years without any recognition, but created the stuff that has allowed the next generation to do the books. And, you know, it's now like, oh, they just popped up yesterday.
Yeah.
You know, somebody just invented Superman last Tuesday, and you know, so we can do whatever we want. And, you know, to some extent, yeah, you can, but by the same token, don't ignore the fact that, you know, other people did it.
Just because you can do something
doesn't mean you should. Yeah. Yes, it's the Jurassic Park.
Yeah. Like, see, I was born in 90, so I'm 24 years old.
Get off my show.
No. But see, I like going back and reading some of the older stuff from the Golden Age and the Silver Age and the Bronze Age. You know, I was at a convention back in the last one that we had here. and I met Daryl Banks, who was on Green Lantern in the 90s, and he co-created Kyle Rayner, so I got to talk to him about how I liked Kyle and everything like that. And we had a good discussion about that. And his table was pushed, you know, by some of the vendors. And there wasn't a very long line for him either.
Right.
Do you remember our table a few years ago and Michael Golden was around the corner?
Yeah.
From us, and I was sitting there the entire time going, I really want to go over and talk to him.
It's Michael Golden.
But
it's Michael Golden.
But I'm kind of scared.
Yeah.
I was a huge fan of his Micronauts run, and I loved his art style. And he actually inspired me as an artist. One of the reasons I have a design degree is Michael Golden. So it's just like, I kept going, I should go over there. Oh, duh, I shouldn't say, I'm a grown-up.
Yeah.
But it, you know, you had those people who inspire you, and I think that one of the things that we luckily have the recognition of is that there is this history, and that there is this line of creators going back, artists and writers, and maybe at the time when we were starting reading, we didn't know the names, but eventually we did sit there and realize, I really like the stories written by this guy, or I really like the art drawn by this guy. And I think that's one of the reasons that New 52 bothers me so much, is that you're right. It does feel like they're not paying attention to what's come before. And I have no problem. I have no problem with DC having a ultimate line, basically. You know, that doesn't bother me at all. It's another universe. Great. Fantastic. And maybe what's coming up is this return to everything. We get our original universe back and that history back.
Maybe.
And it has the old DC Bullet logo. All the books with the
and you can for the new fans who love New 52, because I know there are people out there who do. They can have it. It's gonna still be there. But give me back my history. Give me back my give it all back.
You know, it's kinda like when I meet I'm contacted by a lot of like really, really young screenwriters, and a lot of that has to do with, you know, my children growing up and meeting parents, and they have older children, and they're like, oh, they're taking an interest in this and blah blah blah, and pretty much the first thing I say to them is just respect what came before you. Respect that this has been going on for a long time, and there was a William Goldman, and there was, you know, all these other writers and stuff like that, and all these, there was an Alfred Hitchcock, there was an Orson Welles. You have to respect that. Now go do whatever what the hell you want, but respect what came before you, and you're not better than it. And I remember 15 years ago, back before comic cons were big deals, and I remember I just happened upon the Kansas City Comic Con in Overland Park, and it was like there was like nobody there, but there were writers and artists. And I remember I just went up to Marv Wolfman and sat at his table for 45 minutes and talked to him and said, and I just sat there and I was like, Christmas morning, my dad sat Crisis 12 on the kitchen counter because he had worked late and he picked it up on his way home. And I got up in the morning. I didn't go to my stocking. I didn't go to my presents. I sat at the kitchen counter and I read Crisis 12. And it was at that moment that I knew I was a writer. And I was just like, can I go buy you a cup of coffee? You know, and now, you know, the crowds and such are now, granted, you know, they're not lining up at Marv Wolfman's table. You know, but
Fool's Day.
But back then it was just so empty.
Yeah.
You know, the comic cons and stuff, because you were still a nerd back then.
Everybody was living in the basement with their moms.
You know, it was still considered that. And the only people they would, you know, bring in like old Playboy Playmates, you know, and that was like the big draw at comics, you know. So
how things have changed.
And now, you know, how many did we have last year at Kansas City?
35,000, 40,000.
Yeah. You know?
Yeah.
So that's... there's
here in Dallas last May.
Yeah. That's my origin story.
A lot of the conventions are now really big, but, you know, like Bob said, the artists, the people who are responsible for all of this ever happening, are getting, you know, they're virtually ignored, and you have the, you know, flavor of the month, you know, the actor or whoever that plays these characters.
Not to knock some of these actors.
No.
Knock the movies with the television. This is a way of getting these stories out.
Yeah, it
still
is a good way. But something that Bob mentioned. You know, you talk about the fact that, you know, public perception is Clark Kent works at the Daily Planet, and all of this. what the guys, I think, at New 52, what I think they're tending to ignore as well, not only the fact that there is all of this history on these characters, but also the fact, and we ran into this with Star Trek as well, you know, because a lot of people complain about J.J. Abrams' version of Star Trek, and people said, well, you know, it'll get people interested, and they'll go back to the old stuff. You know, it'll get them interested in watching the others. And my answer to that is, well, wait a minute, if they see this and they like it, and they get interested in this, and they go back to try to find other stuff, it's going to be completely different.
Mm-hmm.
You know, there is no history at DC that is resembles New 52. If I get interested, you know, Man of Steel gets me interested in Superman, I'm going to go back and look at a lot of the back issues, and Superman doesn't have any resemblance at all to the character we saw in Man of Steel. And I think that's going to be a problem moving forward. And something else that Bob mentioned earlier, you know, Warner Brothers, the attitude that Warner Brothers has toward these characters, you can see that huge difference, that we've talked about this before, in the way that the two studios have announced their projects. You know, when Marvel rents out the El Capitan Theater and does this huge big presentation with Kevin Feige, and you got fans and you got press, and you have this major deal.
It's like the NFL draft.
And even then, when we saw the thing with Secret Wars this week, you know, Tom Brevoort and Axel Alonso down at Midtown Comics, and they go live on YouTube, and they've got people there, and they're on Twitter, and they do all this stuff. And the Warner Brothers DC stuff, we find out because Kevin Tsujihara was on a conference call with investors, and somebody just happened to hear it.
Well, I think there's one thing you have to bear in mind here. First of all, it's Marvel Studios.
Yeah.
Right.
Yeah, and not DC Studios.
Right, there you go. There's a big distinction right there.
Right.
Because this is Warner Brothers Pictures, and Marvel Studios.
Right.
These are very different animals, and they've got very different focuses, and this is potentially a problem. But again, remember the DC universe, and I'm not going to get into a defending Man of Steel argument, but the reality is that we've got one movie.
Right. No, and I understand that.
One movie. And we get a second one, and then we've got two movies. That's not a universe either.
And if that one fails, they'll reboot it.
Yeah, so
yeah.
Marvel, it's a different model. And we keep, and as much as it is tempting to bash on DC...
And let's rephrase that a little bit, though, because Marvel, there's a difference between Marvel Studios at Sony and Marvel Studios at Disney.
Well, that's true. Yeah, because, and I understand that, but I'm saying, you know, the company's attitude toward the fans
distinct. You know, as much as, you know, we kind of turned in the latter part of this into DC is awful, which is, you know,
quite that's not because, the case, and we don't want to say that DC is awful.
And I think that it is very easy to go after something like Man of Steel because it's not the movie a lot of us were expecting or wanting. But you know what? It was an incredibly popular film.
Yeah.
It told them that they might have a cinematic universe in the making.
Right.
And so they started to make one. But it's a different thing. Remember that Marvel had been making... There have been Marvel films before. Remember the Punisher movies? How many Punisher movies did we get, kids? We got three. Yeah. Guess how many of them were successful?
None.
Even the good ones weren't successful.
You know, how many, you know, we got two terrible Wolverine movies. I mean, sorry, they were awful.
Yeah, they were
bad. You know, it's just, Generation X on television. Remember Generation X on television?
I don't remember.
We had a TV movie, and it, with Emma Frost and Banshee.
I never saw it.
Marvel had 20 years of trying to bring their stuff to the screen and botched it.
Yeah.
And then they went almost bankrupt and blah blah blah, and suddenly now they got it right. Yeah. But you know,
I want to let Bob have the last word because we've gone long. Bob, what did you think of Man of Steel?
What did I think of Man of Steel?
Yeah,
I found it boring and tedious and a waste of time.
There you go.
Well, hopefully this show has not been boring and tedious and a waste of time for anybody who's been listening. We do appreciate you guys sticking with us because we've gone a little bit long. And we could talk about this all day, week, I'm sure. Let me say,
everybody go out and do as I just did by buying The Secret History of AA Comics by Bob Rzekas. You can, buy it with one click on Amazon on your phone right now.
And also available there, The Answer Man's Book of Trivia Quizzes. These are two books that that Bob Rzekas has written, and it is available over on Amazon. And we will link to those in our show notes. And Bob Rzekas, thank you very much for joining us in the what turned out to be an echo chamber of sorts.
Yeah.
I don't know where that's coming from still. But we do appreciate you taking the time to sit with us and chat. Hopefully we'll be able to do it again at some point. And
it was a pleasure. I'm glad I got to join in.
Well, hopefully you can do it again.
It was a definite pleasure. Thank you.
Yes. And Jeff Hackworth in Fort Worth, Kendall Sen, Tim Harvey, for everyone here at Sci-Fi From Your Radio, Jason Hunt, thank you for listening. You can subscribe if you've been shared, somebody shared this link with you. You can subscribe over at iTunes, and we're also available through the apps OneCast, Double Twist, Stitcher. And, of course, you can always read all of our latest news over at scififorme.com. That's going to do it for this month's Rogues Gallery. And we will be back with another one soon. Thanks for joining us, everyone.
Bye-bye.
This has been a presentation of scififorme.com. Copyright 2015 by Flaming Dog Media, LLC. All rights reserved. No portion of this program may be retransmitted without the express written consent of Flaming Dog Media. You're listening to Sci-Fi For Me Radio.